And we're back with Kevin Benderman. He's a combat veteran, having served one tour in Iraq in 2003, during which a captain in his command ordered soldiers from Benderman's outfit to fire on children throwing rocks at unit personnel. Benderman has applied for conscientious objector status, and we have him on the phone now with us. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, how are you today?
Great, how are you doing?
Oh, pretty good, thank you.
And his wife, Monica, also joined us.
Hi.
So, we were just wondering, so how long have you been in the Army then? It says, I think, you're a veteran, but how long have you been?
I've been in for 10 years now. My original tour was from January of 87 until April of 1991. Then I had a break, and I came back in June of 2000.
Okay, and why did you join the Army?
The reason that I joined the Army, well, my family's had a history of military service since the American Revolution. And, you know, you grow up and you hear different family members doing this or that. You know, both my grandfather served in World War One. My father was in World War Two. I had an uncle that went to Korea. And so it was kind of like a family history of military service.
All right. And you've been to Iraq once. You've done one tour there, I understand.
Yes, I was in Iraq from March 2003 until September 2003.
And have you been overseas anywhere else with the U.S. Army?
No, that's the only overseas tour I've ever done.
Is that the first combat?
Yes.
You've seen?
Yeah.
So I guess it's not a situation where a lot of people say, you know, oh, he's just wimping out and he wants to leave, and oh, he just didn't like it or something. I mean, you've seen a lot of battle, you've been to a lot of different places. How was this different when you went there in 2003 than other places that you've been and other things you've seen?
Well, you can go through all the training that the military has, and then you can go to actual combat, and then you can see firsthand just how devastating war is to people. And it's kind of hard to explain to someone who's never been. It isn't like training at all. I mean, you can rehearse things all day, but until you actually seen it, you never realize just how devastating it is to people.
Sergeant Benderman, we interviewed recently a Marine sergeant, I believe, named Jimmy Massey. And he resisted being classed as a conscientious objector, and he said what he was objecting to, rather, was to illegal war. So can I ask you, what is a conscientious objector exactly? Because I believe that's the status that you're going for, right? That's
what you are. A conscientious objector is a person who, through their experiences and moral or ethical training, as opposed to all war.
Okay. And when did you decide that you were going to object in this way, and why?
Well, you can't just sit there and say that it's, okay, on this minute, on this day, I'm going to become this type of person. You know, it's based on a lifetime of experience and seeing different things and reading and hearing, and, you know, you go through changes as you grow in life. And then seeing actual combat and what war and how devastating it is to people firsthand, you know, that led me to believe that there was no other choice for me other than to say that I cannot participate in this any longer.
And with Jimmy, we found that he was saying that it wasn't so much that he opposed defending his country or he opposed combat per se, it was more for him that it was particularly this war, and that he saw this war as being illegal, and that's why he was resisting the conscientious objector thing, because it was particular to this war for him.
Well, he has every right to make up his mind on what he wants to decide for himself.
Yeah.
And that's all that I'm doing for me. I've made up my mind on what I want to do for myself. And I right now, I believe in my heart that there is no purpose for war in this modern world that we live in, because we should be able to figure out a better way with all the advances and knowledge and technology that we have to solve our differences in a much more civilized and humane way than war.
For most of us, this is the only war that we've seen. You know, you've got the veterans from Vietnam, but most of them aren't really participating in this war. Everybody that we've talked to, the veterans that we've talked to, are remembering what they went through in Vietnam through what's happening now. And we've received a lot of email messages and letters from veterans that are, they express those memories and talk about how they felt, and they understand a lot of what Kevin's remembering now. So that kind of makes us realize, you know, this is our war experience, but it's not the only war experience, and all war isn't, you know.
You're saying as well, like, just going back to something you said a bit earlier, that it would be hard for some people to believe, like, what the reality of war is. And I think that, you know, people that have been on the ground are the only ones that truly know the horror of it. And you're saying in an earlier interview that we read about other soldiers that were there with you and the way in which they were reacting, like, almost as if it was a video game.
Well, there were some young soldiers there that I don't really believe caught the full extent of just how bad it really is. I mean, when we were first there, they just didn't realize, and, you know, it seems like what they were taking is a video game mentality to it, and like, oh, wow, look at this, and oh, look at that. Well, you know, you have to keep your head down, because over there, if you stick your head up at the wrong time, you will die.
You know, you can liken it to, look at the people that slow down on an interstate to see an accident. You know, they're the people that were in that accident being loaded into the ambulances and what they feel. And then the people that are slowing down to watch that accident, until they're in, and you pray that no one is ever in an accident. You hope that they never have that experience. But, you know, people are, they're going to have an entirely different feeling of what they're looking at when they've been the ones that have hit that guardrail or hit another car.
Right, yeah. Kevin, you said in, I believe, an interview with Robert Finnegan that, or I'm quoting something he wrote anyway, that you said, the people we are fighting now, and for the most part, people are for the most part people like you and me, people that are defending themselves against a superior military force, fighting to keep what is rightfully theirs. And then you say that the Iraqi people have the right to choose their own form of government, like Americans did after the revolution. Do you believe that the U.S. military actions in Iraq are helping to secure free democratic elections?
Well, again, like I've said, I am speaking out against all war, not just the war in Iraq or the war in Vietnam or the one that's going to be happening 5 years from now. We need to figure out how to conduct ourselves in a much more civilized and sane manner than war.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you 100%.
And it seems kind of ridiculous that that's some way that we'd ever get democracy, is to kind of bomb and force people into democracy.
What has been the Army's reaction to this? How are they treating you, and how are they treating this situation?
Well, I am currently on leave from the military. They've granted me 2 weeks' leave. I mean, it's kind of hard to answer that question, because you say the Army, well, there's people that are within the military community that don't believe in what I'm doing. There's some that do believe what I'm doing. So when you say the Army, I guess their official stance is I am allowed to put my packet forth, because I have every right to submit conscientious objector packet to be considered and reviewed.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
That's what they're doing now.
I read also the letter that the chaplain wrote to you. And,
yeah, it was kind of surprising.
It was very disturbing. I would not expect myself to get a letter like that from basically the Army priest saying that you should be ashamed, and he was ashamed. How do you, like, and in afterwards you said that all of your military training as a professional soldier hadn't prepared you to respond to something like that. Do you have any other feelings on that now?
That still stands. I mean, how do you respond to that? That I guess that he has every right to state his opinion and his belief.
Isn't he the one that you go to when you want to submit a conscientious objector packet?
Well, the way it works is you submit the request to your commander, and then your commander sets up an interview with a chaplain, and then you have a mental health evaluation. But yes, the chaplain is supposed to determine whether or not, in his opinion, that you are sincere in your beliefs and your stance on applying for a conscientious objection packet.
Mm.
But I mean, like I said, I don't know how to respond to that, and I just anyone else that has read that will have to make up their own mind on what that chaplain believes.
Yeah, it was close to bullying in my mind, or shaming anyway.
It was surprising because I thought that the role of the chaplain was to kind of support people in their decisions and to provide spiritual guidance and relief, and it doesn't seem like he was doing that at all. Also, we read some interesting stuff about your platoon. I don't know if that's the right word, but that there's quite a lot of people who have been leaving.
In your battalion.
Battalion.
Well, you know, I can't really go into all that information. All I can tell you about is my decision on applying for a conscientious objector. And if any of those individuals, if that's what they are doing, they will have to discuss that for themselves.
Okay.
So what is what is going to happen to you now, Kevin? Do you know, like, you have a court martial to attend?
Well, I, on the 7th of February, I have what is known as the Article 32 hearing, and that's kind of like a discovery trial to where the Army determines whether or not to go to court-martial or to handle this in a non-judicial punishment type way or how they want to pursue this matter.
Okay, and this is, from what I understand as well, you've taken something of a risk because you're going to a general courts martial?
Yes, it will be a general court martial. And in light of the fact that I've spoken out about my convictions, I had to act on them as well, because if you speak to it, that's all you're doing is paying lip service to it, and I'm not going to just pay lip service to it. I'm going to follow through on what I say.
How is your family? You say that you have a long history in your family of military service. How do they feel about this?
Some of them are for, some of them are against, and some of them are just
trying to understand.
Yes.
Right.
I guess it must have been a fairly difficult decision to come to. I mean, I think a lot of people think that this is perhaps the easy way out, that you can just call yourself a conscientious objector and then you don't have to go, but it seems that there's a lot of perhaps bullying and coercion and you know, the push toward patriotism and all of that stuff. So, you know, was that difficult for you? How long did it take you to arrive here?
Well, see, that is something that you have to weigh out. I mean, you have people that you have served with in the military, and you have to look and say, okay, am I abandoning these people? Am I leaving them in a position where they will not have the guidance or the leadership that they need, or do you weigh it against your personal convictions and what you believe is best for your life?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's more difficult to think about all of that, and then it seems like once he's made that choice, no matter what the challenge is, you can get through it because you know you're doing the right thing.
Yes, I mean, you have to look at it that way, because those people that some individuals may say that I've abandoned people, but they're all grown men, and they're all grown women. They're going to have to make up their own minds on how they want to conduct themselves. And
yeah.
I felt that there was no other way, no other choice for me other than to, after my experiences, declare myself opposed to all war.
Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, it's not as if you just all of a sudden, like, ran off the battlefield.
No, I spent my time over there. I was over there for almost 7 months.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent my time there, and when I came back, that's when you really start examining what you've done and where you've been in your life. And you have to, I had to re-examine my priorities on what I wanted to do. I had to be able to sleep, at night.
Yeah.
And did I want to take the chance of harming people that, in my opinion, shouldn't be harmed, or should I just remove myself from that process altogether?
People came into our life once this decision was made, but there was a long process of getting to this decision where those people were going on with their life and things were happening, and they had no clue that Kevin was here struggling with this, you know?
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden he makes his decision, and people are saying, wow, how could he do that? Well, you know, he's 40 years old. He's been thinking. things. You just haven't known him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point to bring up, because I don't put my business in the street. And just some people, they may have the appearance, or it may appear to them that, well, this was just a snap decision. This guy just are trying to avoid combat. Well, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that that's not a scary place to be. And anyone who tells you that it isn't is telling you a lie. Okay, but they don't know me. They don't know how long I've thought about this thing. They don't know what I've gone through or what I've seen and experienced in order for me to come to the position that I'm in now.
Yeah.
So, again, I don't put my business in the street. And if they want to say, well, he's just doing this for this, well, I'd say to them, they need to get to know me before they make that kind of judgment about me.
I still think about the question that, you know, people are more concerned with how he arrived at this decision to not fight, to not go back to kill anybody else. But it doesn't seem to bother anybody. They don't ask the questions of how many soldiers that, you know, are killing. I don't understand that. That's to me, that, you know, it seems like the wrong question's being asked.
How are they taking the decision to go and kill rather than
exactly.
not? Exactly.
Yeah. You know, why is it that there's no struggle to go and kill, but when somebody has a struggle and comes to a conscious choice of not killing any longer, that war is wrong, it's such a big deal. You know,
that's a good point.
Just doesn't make sense to me.
That's an excellent point. We saw some disturbing footage of a very, very young soldier, I believe a Marine, who looked to be about 17 years old, talking about how they just killed a guy that was down on the ground, and he was pretending to celebrate it, but he was not comfortable with what he had done, and it's very disturbing. It is a strange thing that we just accept that this is right to go over there and go to war, and you're right, when somebody says, no, you know what, this isn't right. Indeed.
Nobody questions their sanity. And then here, Kevin had to go through a psychological process. You know, they had to declare him sane because he basically filed it for conscientious objector status.
That's weird, eh?
And that's a good point, too. I mean, look at what we do to our young men and women. We tell them that they're honorable and that they're heroes if they can sight through a rifle, the sights of a high-powered rifle, and shoot another human being, or they can throw a hand grenade. I mean, if that's all honorable endeavors, why are we teaching our children this when they're 5 years old? You know, here, throw this hand grenade. Learn how to throw it further than anybody else instead of throwing a baseball or a football or, or learning something in whatever endeavor that you can teach your children other than war. I mean, if it's so such an honorable thing, why don't you see it all in the yard, in the front yards all across America?
Well, we do. We have. There comes a turning point, I think. Like, there's a long time in kids' lives when we try not to let them play with guns and not to let them play violent games, and then at a certain point, we sort of push them in another direction.
Yeah.
It's very, yeah.
Or get surprised when they act violent toward each other.
Yeah.
Right.
And you teach your kids not to solve their differences with violence. Well, what is war? It's the ultimate in violence.
Indeed.
So if we're going to teach our children that, then shouldn't we remember that when we become adults?
And do you think that you kind of, like, with all the training that you go through and stuff, by the time you get out to the actual war, do you feel like you're prepared for the kind of stuff you're going to see out there?
Well, again, I mean, you can train, but you don't actually see, non-combatants in a mass grave site where a dog is eating the corpse. You don't see that in training. Okay, those are some of the things. You don't see a little girl standing on the side of the road begging for help because her arm is burned to a crisp all the way up to her shoulder. You don't see that in training.
Look at the games that kids play now. Even, you know, they're going out to the paintball field. You know, they're playing the paintball and laser tag and things like that. You know, they get up, they walk away. You know, they have stains on their clothes. You know, blue, green, yellow, red stains on their clothes. But they get up and they walk away, they change their clothes, and it's done.
You can shoot somebody, and it not only does it not hurt, it's fun and it's a laugh.
And you pay to do it. You pay money to go to a paintball field and do this. You know,
yeah, but when you shoot someone with a high-powered rifle, they don't get up. I mean, you know, if they do get up, they have serious bodily damage done. So it's not, you know, it's just, to me, I can't understand why I agree with my wife, why so many people question me on this. I mean, this is not a game.
Mm-hmm.
This is reality.
Yeah, and one thing I've noticed in the media as well is that when when they talk to generals and stuff, very often if they're high-ranking generals and they've seen a lot of war, they're often a lot more cautious about going to war and about the whole beating the drums and stuff. They kind of say, well, you know, and they're often a lot more conservative about it, whereas a lot of the officials in the government in America, I've found, haven't actually seen war themselves, and so they're so gung-ho about it. But I wonder, I mean, they must be so gung-ho because they've never seen it, and their families have never seen it, and they don't actually know what it's about.
Well, I can't answer the questions for those individuals or how they come about their beliefs. All I can tell you is my experiences and what I've seen. Mm-hmm. And even watching some of the news shows in this country is like, Showdown in Iraq, the war in Iraq. You know, it's like it's a Monday night movie of the week or something, and it's not that way. I mean, it's just, you can't really fully understand how insane it is to teach 18-year-old kids that you're an honorable person if you can do this until you've actually seen it and you've been there and you smelled it and you've heard it and you've experienced it for yourself. I can't understand. I don't know if I had the words to be able to express that to anyone, how crazy it really is.
You know, at one point we were in a sergeant major's office and we were talking, and I asked him, I said, sir, have you ever shot anybody? And, you know, we talked back and forth for a little bit, and he said, but you know, he said, I wish that I could get it through these guys' heads. The heads of the soldiers where it bothers them, I need to teach them how to shoot and look away. He said, I wish that I could find a way to teach these soldiers coming up, he said, because, you know, I see that it bothers them when they're out there doing this, but I just can't get it in their head that they should shoot and look away so they don't see what they did. And you think, you know what, now I think we need to make sure that somebody looks and sees so that they can say, I'm not doing this ever again.
No kidding. That's extremely disturbing. That to say that and to realize that if you have to tell them to shoot and look away, what they're doing must be a terrible thing.
And somebody must know it if that's how they feel like they have to, exactly. If this is how they have to instruct these guys, then they know why they're instructing them.
So is the situation in Iraq not what I, you know, I mean, I think a lot of people think it's bad guys against the good guys, and it's not that cut and dry?
Well, what war is?
Is any human endeavor that cut and dried? I mean, I'm not trying to be short, but is anything we really do just that black and white, that cut and dried?
Mm-hmm. I think we romanticize a lot about the Second World War because we look back on Hitler, and he was sort of almost like a black and white bad guy, the way he's been painted historically anyway.
But
well,
no.
My father was in World War II, okay? And some of the stories that he started telling me after I joined the military, because he never talked to me about these things until I was in the military. But he told me in France and Belgium when he was over there, he had to walk 5 miles across frozen dead soldiers before he could step off on the ground. So, you know, you can romanticize anything, but the reality of it is always different than a romanticized version of what
mm-hmm.
you see on in the movies.
And don't you have to look at the fact that, you know, you got to be a little bit more humble there, that yes, we have this country here, but the things that we do in this country, other people in their countries are trying to do the same thing, you know. So where do you decide to call one person an enemy and one person a friend, you know? People need to be able to look at that. Ultimately, we're all people. We all want the same things. You know, so maybe if you could look at it that way, you're not an enemy. You're a person that speaks a different language that really wants the same things for your family, but maybe your culture teaches you to give them to your family in a different way. You know, and what's wrong with that? Nothing.
Yeah.
Another example of how things aren't so black and white. We were reading a news item on the show just earlier in our news section, and it was from a German magazine, and it was saying that now that there's the elections coming up, that there's all these troops being deployed to sort of protect, and they're called anti-terror units and stuff, and so it's the usual stuff that you hear on the news, but then the reality is that a third of the force are actually ex-Iraqi security troops, which were given special honors and decorations by Saddam Hussein. So it all kind of gets a bit blurry then, because you start thinking, well, who exactly are the insurgents, and are these insurgent stronghold houses, are they really just civilian houses, and how can people tell the difference? And I imagine that must be really psychologically difficult as well, trying to discern who's who, and, you know, is that an insurgent in civilian clothes? I mean, what does that mean, you know?
Well, I can't really, I mean, I don't know how to answer that question, because
it doesn't matter. You got to lose the politics of it. You got to look at, you know, if you look too close at the specifics, it gets to be politics. It becomes an enemy, a friend, versus, if you just look at, this is what war does.
Yeah.
War destroys people. It destroys homes. It destroys countries. It divides countries. So clearly, no matter who the people involved are, war isn't going to solve a problem.
Yeah.
And if you take the politics and you take that aspect to what can we do good as opposed to how can we destroy, then in all cases, war is not going to solve the problem.
And to add to that, once you see what resources of everyone involved in all this, what resources are used up to destroy things, I mean, can't we figure out a better way to use those resources to benefit mankind as a whole?
Indeed. Yeah, indeed.
Well, we thank you very much for your comments and for answering our questions.
Well, thank you.
We're going to just wrap up now.
I'd just like to say that I agree 100% with your position, and I think it is an excellent point that it's really troubling, and we have to take a step back and look at our whole way of thinking if, as you say, when you realize that war is wrong, that you are then put under psychiatric assessment, that is just a backwards way of thinking.
Exactly.
And that I agree 100% with, I think, your quote, Kevin, that war is, we should see war as a thing of human history. It should be relegated to human history, like slavery and human sacrifice is a great way of thinking, because it shows that we can see that some things are just wrong and
outdated,
aren't working.
Well, sure. I mean, if anyone has to learn about war at all, it should be from the history books. No, another generation should not learn what war is firsthand. I mean, I have stepchildren, and I don't want them to learn what it is. I don't want my grandchildren to have to learn what it is. So why should I get out here and be a proponent of an institution that just involves killing, period?
Regardless of the countries involved, it's wrong, no matter who's involved.
Mm.
Indeed. Do you have anything to say in closing? Anything you'd like to?
Well, again, I would just like I would like people to know, as far as I go in my life and how I've learned about the things that affect me, I don't want to be involved in war. I don't want my children to be involved in war, or my grandchildren. And I think that we should all take a look at ourselves and learn a better way to solve our differences other than war.
Hear, hear.
All right. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Sergeant Kevin Benderman and his wife, Monica. Thanks a lot, and good luck with your continued fight. Or not fight.
Yes.
Bye-bye.
Well, thank you.
Fight of a different kind.
So that was once again Sergeant Kevin Benderman, who has done 7 months over in Iraq, came back to Georgia and started to think about it, and decided that he did not believe that war was an endeavor that humans should be participating in at all.
I think as well, possibly there was a few things that he couldn't talk about, because his case is under review at the moment. And 2 weeks ago, two people from the same battalion as him attempted suicide rather than deploy to Iraq. And furthermore, an additional 17 soldiers in the 27 battalion, his battalion, have gone AWOL for the same reason.
Also, the two that attempted suicide were both being harassed and mistreated on the psychiatric ward of the Wynn Army Hospital by unit commanders and a civilian, Dr. Kapp. In addition, Sergeant Johnston, the platoon sergeant, reportedly told Beals recently, quote, "When I get you to Iraq, I'm going to get you killed."
I want to read the letter from the chaplain. He writes, "It is unfortunate that you have chosen the course of action you have taken. You should have the moral fortitude to deploy with us and see me here in Kuwait to begin your conscientious objector application. As an NCO in the U.S. Army, I expected a greater display of maturity from you. You should be ashamed of the way you have conducted yourself. I certainly am ashamed of you. I hope you will see your misconduct as an opportunity to upgrade your character and moral behavior for your own good and the good of your fellow man." That is a letter from the chaplain. You're listening to Elephant Talk here on CHLY.